For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, a celebration of and a talk with one of the most distinctive and prolific readers in the RNIB Talking Books Library, reader Gabriel Wolfe. Today's show features a voice that may be familiar to all users of RNIB Talking Books, or lovers of audio in general, as his work goes far beyond the RNIB studios. That voice belongs to reader Gabriel Wolfe.
I am still uncertain which surprised me more, the telegram calling my attention to the advertisement, or the advertisement itself. The telegram is before me as I write. It would appear to have been handed in at Vere Street at 8 o'clock on the morning of the 11th of May, 1897, and received before 8:30 at Holloway, B.O. And in that drab region it duly found me, unwashen but at work, before the day grew hot and my attic insupportable. See Mr. Maturian's advertisement, Daily Mail, might suit you, earnestly beg, try, will speak, if necessary. I transcribe the thing as I see it before me, all in one breath, that took away mine, but I leave out the initials at the end, which completed the surprise. They stood very obviously for the knighted specialist whose consulting room is within a cab whistle of Vere Street, and who once called me kinsman for his sins. More recently he had called me other names. I was a disgrace, qualified by an adjective which seemed to me another. I had made my bed, and I could go and lie and die in it.
Gabriel Wolfe reading from Raffles, The Black Mask by E.W. Hornung, one of the many Raffles books narrated by him, along with all of the Arthur Ransom Swallows and Amazon books, books by Dirk Bogarde, Richmal Crompton, Agatha Christie and Charles Dickens. From Mrs. Gaskell to Doctor Who, Gabriel was a prolific reader.
Joe and the Doctor cowered away, crouched behind a pile of crates as the giant hand seemed to reach down for them. It came lower, lower, then, with a slight change of direction, its index finger and thumb closed on the TARDIS. It lifted the police box as a man might pick up a box of matches from a drawer. Holding the TARDIS, the giant hand disappeared through the gap. The Doctor yelled, Hey, that's mine! Bring it back!" His only answer was an echoing clang as the section of hold swung back and darkness returned. Joe's face popped up from behind a crate. "Oh, Doctor, that hand! Has it gone?" "It has. And it's taken the TARDIS with it." Joe stared upward.
"There's no way through, are you sure?"
Part of the hold swung open. Joe looked at the steel wall.
"But that must weigh tons and tons."
"You saw the size of that hand."
"But we've been up there," persisted Joe. "There's only the deck."
"And there must be an optical illusion as well as a temporal one. I told you this was no ordinary ship.
Now we're trapped on it, with the TARDIS gone."
"Don't worry," said the Doctor reassuringly. "It's only a matter of finding where it's gone and getting it back." Joe was almost speechless.
"Only? Well, where do we start?"
"We start by finding a way off this ship." The Doctor started towards the ladder, wondering just how they were going to get off a ship in the middle of the ocean. Joe followed him.
Gabriel Wolfe reading from Doctor Who and the Carnival of Monsters by Terence Dix. And there's a reason he got a number of Doctor Who books to record that we'll touch on later. Although he prefers the term reader over actor, His first credit as an actor was in Tom Brown's School Days in 1951, followed a few years later with a role in the 1953 MGM film Knights of the Round Table, then many other roles on TV. His real love, though, is narration and radio, presenting a large number of literary and musical portraits, and of course reading for the Talking Book Service. A search in the library for his name delivers over 140 books, although that doesn't reflect instances where a book has been replaced by a more up-to-date version, so I suspect the number is much, much higher. And an email that went first to Hamburg via his wife, soprano Felicity Lott's website, to Barcelona, and eventually to Gabriel's home in Sussex. We started a correspondence, got Zoom installed on his computer, and he joined me down the line. I first asked when he started reading for RNIB.
Sometime in the 60s, but exactly when, I don't know. I should imagine about 63, 64. I worked a lot for radio, and so when you were talking to other artists and you talked about work, and I suppose somebody must have said, why don't you go along? It's only up the road. It was Great Portland Street. It was a, and have a word and see if they want you, you know, to do some to do these books. And I went and I got taken on, and it was generally regarded as a charitable act, but it was paid minuscule amounts by the minute of recording. So you did a morning's work and it went on for a couple of hours altogether, probably. It was just a few pounds, £5, £6, £7, £7, something like that. But it was all a help because we were all jobbing actors, just trying desperately to make a living, and newsreaders. But it suited me very well because I have always been interested in reading aloud. And I used to read aloud to myself when I was a child. And it went on, and I read to anybody who would listen, and it still goes on. I still do it.
It all began with William's aunt, who was in a good temper that Saturday morning and gave him a shilling for posting a letter for her and carrying her parcels from the grocer's. Buy some sweets or go to the pictures, she said carelessly as she gave it to him. William walked slowly down the road, gazing thoughtfully at the coin. After deep calculations based on the fact that a shilling is the equivalent of 2 sixpences, he came to the conclusion that both luxuries could be indulged in. He could get into the stalls for sixpence, and that left 6 months, more than enough at the current cost of living, to keep him munching happily while he gazed at the screen. In the matter of sweets, William frankly upheld the superiority of quantity over quality. Moreover, he knew every sweet shop within a 2-mile radius of his home, whose proprietor added an extra sweet after the scale had descended, and he patronised these shops exclusively. With solemn face and eager eye, he always watched the process of weighing, and stingy shops were known and banned by him. He wandered now to his favourite confectioner, and stood outside the window for 5 minutes, torn between the rival attractions of gooseberry eyes and marble balls. Both were sold at 4 ounces for tuppence. William never purchased more expensive luxuries. At last, his frowning brow relaxed, and he entered the shop. 6 pennyworth of gooseberry eyes, he said, with a slightly self-conscious air. The extent of his purchases rarely exceeded a penny. Hello, said the shopkeeper in amused surprise. Got a bit of money this morning, explained William carelessly, with the air of a Rothschild. He watched the weighing of the emerald-green dainties with silent intensity, saw with satisfaction the extra one added after the scale had fallen, received the precious paper bag, and putting 2 sweets into his mouth, walked out of the shop.
And what sort of books do you remember reading? Have you got any favourites that have stuck in your mind?
Not really, because, you know, it came and it went, and I it was a job, and I can remember sort of selecting from the available books, and obviously every George Eliot book that was available I read, because she was the other part of my life for 50 odd years. So Middlemarch was a tremendous thing to do. I loved that. I seem to have enjoyed doing things like Raffles, the Amateur Cracksman. I like that sort of light stuff, but I don't really remember what I read and what I didn't read. Treasure Island, I read that, but I heard that not long ago, and it really wasn't bad. Whereas I can't. I mean, the classic was that they wanted Thucydides' Peloponnesian War recorded, and everybody rejected it, but I didn't. I loved the idea, and I it was an education for me. I hadn't had much education, and so it was a good opportunity. I liked that. I liked those books about archaeology and history and things like that, whereas the other people really liked something, a nice, easy read.
I do not understand these long speeches which the Athenians make. Although they said a great deal in praise of themselves, they made no attempt to contradict the fact that they are acting aggressively against our allies and against the Peloponnese. And surely, if it is the fact that they had a good record in the past against the Persians, and now have a bad record as regards us, then they deserve to pay double for it, since though they were once good, they have now turned out bad. We are the same then and now. And if we're sensible, we shall not allow any aggression against our allies, and shall not wait before we come to their help. They are no longer waiting before being ill-treated. Others may have a lot of money and ships and horses, but we have good allies, and we ought not to betray them to the Athenians. This is not a matter to be settled by lawsuits and by words. It is not because of words that our own interests are suffering. Instead, we should come to the help of our allies quickly and with all our might. And let no one try to tell us that when we are being attacked, we should sit down and discuss matters. These long discussions are rather for those who are meditating aggression themselves. Therefore, Spartans, cast your votes for the honor of Sparta and for war. Do not allow the Athenians to grow still stronger. Do not entirely betray your allies. Instead, let us, with the help of heaven, go forward to meet the aggressor.
So you appreciated a bit of a challenge, but were there any yes. books you were glad to see the back of?
Not as a challenge. Well, yes, I mean, not because it was too difficult, but because it was so badly written. I can't remember what it was. Doctors and Nurses. They begged me to read some popular books as well. And it was a kind of Mills and Boone effort. The writing was so excruciating. It's the only one I took back and said, look, I can't do this because I should just break up every cent. Oh, it was awful. But I just got on with it. I mean, the key to it all was my ability to read at sight. I could make it live without having to work at it. I could just read ahead, and I was very fluent and very coloured. I coloured things a good deal. And I must say that the audience were apparently divided into two: those who liked it living like that and with, you know, characters and dialects and a lot of involvement, and those who preferred the newsreaders because they wanted just to hear the words and put the imagination to work and do it themselves. So it's quite interesting.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show, featuring narrator Gabriel Wolfe. And talking of newsreaders...
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
RNIB Talking Books have always had the privilege of working with some great narrators, many of whom not primarily known for their acting skills. Richard Baker was the first person to read the BBC television news in 1954, although only his voice appeared, as it was feared that he might sully the pure stream of truth with inappropriate facial expressions. Management relented the next year, and he was a familiar face on the news for the next 28 years. He's narrated a number of books for the Talking Book Service, among them two Maigret adventures, some Noel Coward short stories, and Jane Austen's Emma.
Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and happy disposition, seemed to unite some of the best blessings of existence, and had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little to distress or vex her. She was the youngest of the two daughters of a most affectionate, indulgent father, and had, in consequence of her sister's marriage, been mistress of his house from a very early period. Her mother had died too long ago for her to have more than an indistinct remembrance of her caresses, and her place had been supplied by an excellent woman as governess, who had fallen little short of a mother in affection.
That's Richard Baker reading from Jane Austen's Emma. Another book he both wrote and narrated is Here Is the News, published back in 1966. It gives a great insight into the history of BBC News.
It is not often that a television performer gets the chance to step out of the screen, as it were, and talk personally about the job that people watch him doing night after night. When Leslie Frewin asked me to write this book, I set myself a single aim. It was simply to try and answer some of the many questions I've been asked by members of the public during nearly 12 years of television news reading. Now, people sometimes ask serious questions, and sometimes they don't. That's why some of my answers are concerned with professional and technical matters, and others are frankly gayer and more personal. Fortunately, even a job which deals daily in crisis and human tragedy has its less weighty moments. There is something more I must say. I am at present one of the BBC's four regular television newsreaders. This is my personal view of the job we all do, and not necessarily that of my colleagues Robert Dougal, MBE, Michael Aspel, and Corbett Woodall. The first chapter is called 10 Minutes to Transmission. It is 10 minutes to news time, any night of the year. In millions of homes all over the country, people are sitting comfortably in front of their television sets, watching The Man from U.N.C.L.E., or Panorama, or Softly, Softly, and settle down for a few minutes to catch up on the latest news, in the company of a fairly calm-looking character who looks as if he's spent the day combing his hair and relaxing in a chaise longue. That's what the viewer sees at home, or at least we hope he does. But what is it like to be at the other end, on the other side of the looking glass, so to speak? Step through into the unfamiliar world beyond the screens, where as often as not, things are decidedly unexpected.
That's Richard Baker reading from his book, Here Is the News. For more information on this and on other celebrity narrators, head to the Talking Book pages of www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios will come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, How's that? Does that work?
The new digital Bokingtuk?
Bokingtuk, yeah. It's Bokingtuk. A new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake, and if...
Damn.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And staying on that subject, a return to narrator Gabriel Wolfe.
If we made a serious mistake, then we had to stop and he'd have to rewind, and that took time. I don't know how it's done off the screen. I'm not technical and not at all. And no, this is a miracle. I'm doing this on Zoom, and this is my second Zoom of my life.
Actually, the books are recorded remotely now as well. The actors will be in the Talking Book studios, but the engineers are at home these days.
That's interesting, because we say we had an engineer looking after us, but my problem was that I was so fluent and I so rarely made a fluff, as we call it, that they felt quite happy to start the tape and then dash off and have a quiet fag somewhere. And so I had to, quite often, to go and search for them. And that took time, and therefore I lost, a penny or two. It was a mixed blessing, really.
Yeah, you were paid for the time of the final recording, not the time in the studio. That's the same today, right. Actually. Yeah.
It is, yeah.
But what you said is it paid £7 and a good morning, but that covered your mortgage.
Mortgage, yes. It was a small mortgage, but it was, yes. Yeah, it was absolutely that.
You're listening to a special Read On, the audiobook show featuring narrator Gabriel Wolfe. And during the research for the show, while I could find many books in the RNIB library, there wasn't much other audio available. I found reference to it, though. He presents his wide range of literary and musical programmes across the English-speaking world, which has included 12 of the states of North America. In Britain, every major and minor festivals have presented his programmes, solo, duo and with ensembles. As a broadcaster, he has written many plays and documentaries and performed in hundreds of programmes, and has chosen, edited and read more than 40 major novels, including George Eliot's. And as I said, I found reference to them, but unfortunately the audio seems to be lost.
Radio was my love, and all my first life was involved in that, and then I gradually went on doing things that involved reading aloud, because I call myself a reader, not an actor, because I didn't like actors very much. I like musicians, but I didn't like actors. And I devised a huge number of programs. I was thinking about that, which involved getting up on the platform and giving the life and work of writers and of composers, some with music, some with other readers, mainly ones I did myself. But it took me to extraordinary places, really. I mean, I had 10 different states in the North America, taking Jerome K. Jerome to South Dakota, that sort of thing. It's quite extraordinary. But it was lovely, and that's what I loved. I loved reading aloud, and so the first time that I spent was in radio and doing these. And when I wasn't doing it, I was unemployed, more or less.
Now, you've mentioned newsreaders, and we have a couple of books in the library read by Richard Baker, but who were your other fellow narrators?
I thought you were going to ask that, and I can't remember. They were the current newsreaders. They weren't going back as far as Alvar Lidell, but they were, you know, they were the ones you heard all the time. And we do
have books read by Alvar Lidell somewhere in the library.
Gosh, they must go back even to, because I mean they were originally done on a wax disc, as far as I can remember, even before tape.
Yeah, I've heard from an engineer called Ian Turner, who worked with Andrew Timothy, who worked on wax, that the trick to narrating those days wasn't reading fluently, it was covering over mistakes. Because if you made a mistake, the wax was scrapped.
Finished. No, I know. That would be terrible. Terrifying, really. But, I mean, a lot of people couldn't do this and still did it. And that is, to me, quite extraordinary. Because I relied on the fact that, if I was going to do a morning's work, that was it. Whereas I bought from the RNIB a book that had been read so that I could take it home and read it myself for pleasure. And it had been marked up like a music score. The words not only underlined so that was an important word, but it had a stress mark above it. It had like bar lines, so there were gaps. Everything was meticulously. And I mean, I couldn't read. I couldn't read it off the page. I could not have read it like that. But they must have spent a couple of days. But I couldn't give that amount of time to it.
So you didn't read or annotate the scripts beforehand. You just went in and read it. The first time you read it down the microphone was the first time you read it.
Yes, I would probably glance at it just so that I wouldn't be, suddenly realize 2 pages in that I was supposed to be a Russian. It was the first that they'd mentioned it. It was necessary to glance at it. Well, that's a bit different. You could do that on the bus. And I was caught out on one or two occasions, the memorable one being doing Arthur Rubinstein's Life. It was really marvelous. And I turned over a page, and there at the top of the page was a friend of his who had 13 consonants and no vowels in my mind. And I just blew up and, I don't know how I got out of that ever, really, because I couldn't. You couldn't find anybody who would be able to tell you what that was. When you were doing radio, there was a pronunciation department, and you just made a list of things you wanted to know, and it would come phonetically transcribed. But this, you just had to do the best you could.
That's another quote from Andrew Timothy. He said, if you see a word coming up that you've never seen before, say it with such confidence that people begin to doubt themselves over it.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I'm sure I got away with a lot of murder with that sort of thing.
Sweet Danger by Marjorie Allingham. A small window in the sunlit yellow side of the Hôtel Beauregard, Mentone, opened slowly, and through it a hand appeared, which, after depositing a compact brown suitcase upon the sill, speedily vanished. Guffey Randall, who was allowing his car to roll in a leisurely fashion down the gentle slope to the sharp right-angle turn which would bring him to the front of the hotel and lunch, pulled up and observed the now closed window and the bag with that air of polite yet careless interest which was his chief characteristic. It seemed such a foolish thing to do, this leaving of a small brown portmanteau upon the sill of a shut first-floor window. Mr. Randall was stolid, Nordic, and logical. He also had the heaven-sent gift of curiosity. And thus it was that he was still gazing idly at the hotel wall when the sequel of the first incident occurred. A glazed ground floor window was opened cautiously, and a small man in a brown suit began to climb out. It was a very small window, and the unconventional departer seemed more anxious to watch what he was leaving than to see where he was going, so that he came out feet first, his knees resting upon the sill. He moved with remarkable agility, and as Mr. Randall watched, he saw to his astonishment a hand replace an unmistakable revolver in a strained hip pocket.
You've read so many classic stories from the golden age of detective fiction, including Agatha Christie and Marjorie Allingham. Who do you think's the best spinner of a crime yarn?
Tricky, that. It would sound very peculiar, the answer, because I'm a monoglot, really. I do English and that's it. But I love the Maigret books by Simenon. And I read them in English, of course, but I started to read them in French. And I found that I loved them in French, and I could read them in French, and I could understand 99% of it. And it's wonderful, because he wrote very simply on purpose, because he wanted to reach a large audience. And by goodness, he did reach a large audience. So that to read English for a tape or something, I don't know. I enjoyed the Raffles books and Peter Wimsey, I suppose.
One of the books you've read were Dirk Bogarde's memoirs. Did you actually meet Dirk Bogarde?
No, I didn't actually, no. His companion was in a film I did, Knights of the Round Table, Anthony Forward. And that's the nearest I got to Dirk Bogarde. But he was a brilliant piece of writing. So funny. I love that. I've always actually enjoyed the humour of things. And it's extraordinary. I was thinking of all the things that I took over to the States and all around the country, all the different programmes that I devised on life and work. And they were all humorous writers and probably not so well known today by anybody. Yes, Sarkey, I think, is probably well known, but and he was a wonderful storyteller and so funny. But Stephen Leacock, nobody knows. He was born in England, but he went to live in Canada with his family. And I did so many of them that I went over to his old school in Toronto and did my program there. And it's strange because I'm the most miserable, melancholy cuss that anybody come across, but I enjoy making people laugh, and I managed to do that with the way, you know, Dickens was funny too, and I did programs of his. I did so many programs. Anyway, that's by the by. But it just shows that reading aloud is meat and drink to me, and that's why I survived so long in RNIB, I think.
Did you get any feedback at all from listeners?
Oh, yes. Oh, goodness. The around about the same time as I joined Talking Books, I did my first book on radio, which was Ring of Bright Water, which was a fabulous thing to have to do. But I then did Adam Bede, and I was allowed to choose the music for it. And I remember I got something like 300 letters about the reading and 700 letters about the music. But yes, I got a lot, and I kept them for, well, I answered them. But yeah, it was wonderful, actually. It was a big rapport between listener and performer in those days in radio. I don't know if it would be the same.
A low humming note rang through the ship. No one except Joe and the doctor seemed to notice it, but suddenly the atmosphere became hostile and threatening. His eyes blazing with anger, Andrews shouted, "So, you persist in sticking to this ridiculous story, do you?" The doctor said sharply, "And what if I do, sir?" Andrews tossed his rifle to a sailor, stripped off his coat and started to roll up his sleeves. "Then I propose to thrash you within an inch of your life." The three Minorans stared, fascinatedly into the scope. "What a ritual are they performing now?" asked Oram. Vorg looked into his viewing aperture. "Two of the males are about to engage in physical combat, Your Worship." Jo Grant felt she was in some kind of nightmare. Lieutenant Andrews was rolling up his sleeves over brawny arms. The doctor, too, had taken off his coat and was rolling up the sleeves of his ruffled shirt. Jo looked at Andrews, so much younger and stronger than his opponent. "Doctor, you can't," she whispered. The doctor seemed caught up in the prevailing madness. "I most certainly can," he said briskly. "It'll give me the greatest of pleasure to teach this insolent young puppy a much-needed lesson." Tone and manner were quite unlike his normal self. Jo turned to Major Daly and Claire. Surely they would make some protest. "Please," she pleaded, "you've got to stop them. It isn't fair." Neither father nor daughter seemed to hear her. They were leaning forward excitedly, eyes shining with bloodthirsty eagerness, waiting for the fight to begin. Preparations completed, fists clenched and raised, the two opponents moved towards each other.
Now, some of the books in the library you've read are Target Doctor Who books, but there's a reason why you read some of those Doctor Who books.
Yeah, they put me sort of alongside them and said, you were in Doctor Who, you read these. And so I did. Yes, I spent a couple of days doing an enemy of Doctor Who, the god of death, Sutek, in a series called The Pyramid of Mars. And for some extraordinary reason, there were 250 plus storylines of Doctor Who, and for some reason this one always comes in the top 10. And I was watching it only the other day because I was supposed to be talking about it with the producer, and I honestly can't see why it was particularly, I mean, the others must have been dreadful. So yes, that was just extraordinary. I mean, 2 days and it was all over. I mean, I was physically still all the time in the whole show. So I was always on the same chair. So, you know, they could have done away with anybody inside this costume, which had a mask. But the point was that everything had to be done through the voice. And it was apparently a success. And that's fine. And I, you know, forgot about it. And about 20 years later, there started being all these conventions and spin-offs and all sorts of things. They just they dragged me out of wherever I was and got me moving. And it's produced, you know, an income apart from anything else that was quite considerable, considering the small amount that they paid me. But and, you know, a certain amount of notoriety, I suppose you could say.
Who was playing Doctor Who?
That was Tom Baker in those days, that one. And Philip Hinchcliffe and I were talking about the thing, and of course he remembers absolutely everything, and because he was in charge of the whole thing. I was silent. I couldn't remember anything. I was only in a couple of episodes and, you know, not very... It was a minor role.
But you've worked with Russell T. Davis now as well.
That's right. Not with him, I don't think, but for him. I mean, I never got to know any of these people because they never turned up. I mean, the director was up in a box somewhere, and I never met Philip Hinchcliffe. So I was doing another one with David Tennant, and Russell T. Davis, he was one of the people who were for the first one, for the Tom Baker one, was a child behind the sofa peering at it and frightened to death. And he remembered all that when he grew up and became the current savior of Doctor Who. He remembered me when it needed the voice of Satan, the Beast. And I did that with David Tennant. And once again, I never met David Tennant. I just did my stuff in a cubicle. But that's what I do. I do stuff in a cubicle with nobody else there, preferably.
And finally, do you have a message for anyone, the thousands of people who have enjoyed and are currently enjoying your books?
Well, I'm flattered and delighted that there are people out there who enjoy, and I think books are actually better than life, and much more comforting. And the thing about them is, if you meet somebody you don't like in a book, you just shut it up and put it back on the shelf.
Gabriel Wolfe, thank you very much.
Thank you very much too, Robert.
And Gabriel Wolfe will be back with the books of his life after this.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB. See differently.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online, or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
And now a return to Gabriel Wolfe for the books of his life. Is there a book from childhood that you think made you fall in love with reading?
Yes, definitely. No problem. That's Swallows and Amazons, and the series of Swallows and Amazons, which is Winter Holiday and Pigeon Post and all those wonderful. And I still read them. And I recorded them eventually and put them on cassettes and then put them on CDs. I loved them so much that I reread them even as a child. And then I found I was skipping bits and I thought that was not right. Narrative, come on. So I made myself read them aloud to myself, and I had to make them interesting, or I bore myself to death. So I learned very early to read aloud. So yes, those are absolutely I love them. They're brilliantly written, and they're not just for children. They're about children, but they're not just. And I mean, the people who buy my CDs are all, you know, in their 70s and beyond. It's a sort of nostalgic thing.
Roger, age 7, and no longer the youngest of the family, ran in wide zigzags to and fro across the steep field that sloped up from the lake to Holly Howe, the farm where they were staying for part of the summer holidays. He ran until he nearly reached the hedge by the footpath, and then turned and ran until he nearly reached the hedge on the other side of the field. And then he turned and crossed the field again. Each crossing of the field brought him nearer to the farm. The wind was against him, and he was tacking up against it to the farm, where at the gate his patient mother was awaiting him. He couldn't run straight against the wind because he was a sailing vessel, a tea clipper, the Cutty Sark. His elder brother John had said only that morning that steamships were just engines in tin boxes. Sail was the thing, and so, though it took rather longer, Roger made his way up the field in broad tacks. When he came near his mother, he saw that she had in her hand a red envelope and a small piece of white paper, a telegram. He knew at once what it was. For a moment he was tempted to run straight to her. He knew that telegrams came only from his father
and that this one must be the answer to a letter from his mother and letters from John, Susan, Titty and himself, all asking the same thing, but asking it in different ways. His own letter had been very short. "Please, Daddy, may I too, with love, Roger." Titty's had been much longer, longer even than John's. Susan, though she was older than Titty, hadn't written a letter of her own. She'd put her name with John's at the end of his, so that these two had sent one letter between them. Mother's letter had been the longest of all, but Roger didn't know what she'd said in it. All the letters had gone together, a very long way, to his father, whose ship was at Malta, but under orders for Hong Kong. And there, in his mother's hand, was the red envelope that had brought the answer. For a moment, Roger wanted to run straight to her, but sail was the thing, not steam, so he tacked on, heading perhaps a little closer to the wind. At last he headed straight into the wind, moved slower and slower, came to a stop at his mother's side, began to move backwards, and presently brought up with a little jerk, anchored and in harbour. "Is it the answer?" he panted, out of breath, after all that beating up against the wind. "Does he say yes?" Mother smiled and read the telegram aloud. "Better drowned than duffers. If not, duffers won't drown." "Does that mean yes?" asked Roger. "I think so." "Does it mean me too?" "Yes, if John and Susan will take you, and if you promise to do whatever they tell you." "Hurrah!" shouted Roger and capered about, forgetting for a moment that he was a ship and anchored in a quiet harbour.
That's Gabriel Wolfe himself, reading Swallows and Amazons, the first book in the series by Arthur Ransom, available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. Is there a book that you go back to again and again in a rainy day to reread?
I love the Riddle of the Sands. I love Rogue Mail. I love those. They're two superb adventure stories, one on the water, one on a boat. One is a tremendous, wonderful yarn of escaping. Rogue Mail, he takes a pot shot at Hitler. And they try to kill him, but they kind of fail, and he manages to escape, and it's just a chase, and it's wonderful, wonderful writing.
I arrived on the ground at dawn and spent the whole day in reconnaissance. It was an alarming day, for the forest surrounding the house was most efficiently patrolled. From tree to tree and gully to gully, I prowled over most of the circuit, but only flat on the earth was I really safe. Often I hid my rifle and glasses, thinking that I was certain to be challenged and questioned. I never was. I might have been transparent. I have learned the trick of watching shadows and standing motionless in such a position that they cut and dapple my outline. Still, there were times when even a rhinoceros could have seen me. Here, at any rate, they had considered the offensive possibilities of the rifle. At all points commanding the terrace and the gardens, clearings had been cut. Nobody, even at extreme ranges, could shoot from cover. Open spaces, constantly crossed by guards, there were in plenty. I chose the narrowest of them, a ride some 50 feet broad which ran straight through the woods and ended at the edge of a low cliff. From the grass slope above the cliff, the terrace and doors leading on to it were in full sight. I worked out the range as 550 yards. I spent the night on a couch of pine needles, well hidden under the mother tree, and finished my provisions and slept undisturbed. A little before dawn, I climbed a few feet down the cliff and squatted on a ledge where the overhang protected me from anyone who might peer over the brink. A stunted elder, clawing at the gravel with the tips of its top-heavy roots, was safe enough cover from distant eyes looking upwards. In that cramped position, my rifle was useless, but I could, and very clearly, see the great man, were he to come out and play with the dog, or smell a rose, or practice gestures on the gardener. A path ran across the bottom of the ride, just above my head, and continued along the lower edge of the woods. I timed the intervals at which I heard footsteps, and discovered that somebody crossed the ride every 14 minutes. As soon as I was certain of that, I came out of hiding and followed. I wanted to understand his exact routine. He was a young guard of splendid physique, with loyalty written all over him, but he had, I should think, hardly been out of an industrial town in his life. He couldn't have seen me if I had been under his feet. He knew perfectly well that he was not alone, for he looked over his shoulder again and again and stared at the bush or the fold in the ground where I was. But of course he put his sensation down to nervousness or imagination. I treated him with disrespect, but I liked him.
Rogue Mail by Geoffrey Household is narrated by Robin Brown and is available from RNIB Talking Books. As is Riddle of the Sands, a record of Secret Service recently achieved by Erskine Childers. It's narrated by another classic voice, George Hagen.
The Riddle of the Sands by Erskine Childers. I've read of men who, when forced by their calling to live for long periods in utter solitude, had made it a rule to dress regularly for dinner, in order to maintain their self-respect and prevent a relapse into barbarism. It was in some such spirit, with an added touch of self-consciousness, that at 7 o'clock in the evening of September the 23rd in a recent year, I was making my evening toilet in my chambers in Pall Mall. I thought the date and the place justified the parallel, to my advantage even, for the obscure Burmese administrator might well be a man of blunted sensibilities and coarse fibre, and at least he is alone with nature, while I, well, a young man of condition and fashion, who knows the right people, belongs to the right clubs, has a safe, possibly a brilliant future in the Foreign Office, may be excused for a sense of complacent martyrdom when, with his keen appreciation of the social calendar, he is doomed to the outer solitude of London in September.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Well, I would go, I think, straight away to The Natural History of Selborne. I think it is extraordinary. It's written in 1770, thereabouts, 1784, goes up to them. And he writes so beautifully with such colour and exactitude, and it's all about the natural life around him. He observes the swallows and the swifts and the house martins, and he describes what they do and how they do it, and the observation is phenomenal. I think it's a remarkable book, and it's absolutely timeless.
Among the singularities of this place, the two rocky, hollow lanes, the one to Alton and the other to the forest, deserve our attention. These roads, running through the Malm lands, are, by the traffic of ages and the fretting of water, worn down through the first stratum of our freestone and partly through the second, so that they look more like watercourses than roads, and are bedded with naked rag for furlongs together. In many places they are reduced 16 or 18 feet beneath the level of the fields, and after floods and in frosts exhibit very grotesque and wild appearances from the tangled roots that are twisted among the strata and from the torrents rushing down from their broken sides, and especially when those cascades are frozen into icicles, hanging in all the fanciful shapes of frostwork. These rugged, gloomy scenes affright the ladies when they peep down into them from the paths above, and make timid horsemen shudder while they ride along them, but delight the naturalist with their various botany, and particularly with their curious filices with which they abound.
Thank you.
The manor of Selborne, was it strictly looked after with its kindly aspects and all its sloping coverts, would swarm with game. Even now, hares, partridges, and pheasants abound, and in old days woodcocks were as plentiful. There are few quails, because they more affect open fields than enclosures. After harvest, some few landrails are seen. The parish of Selborne, by taking in so much of the forest, is a vast district. Those who tread the bounds are employed part of 3 days in the business, and are of the opinion that the outline in all its curves and indentings does not comprise less than 30 miles. The village stands in a sheltered spot, secured by the hanger from the strong westerly winds. The air is soft, but rather moist from the effluvia of so many trees, yet perfectly healthy and free from agues. The inhabitants enjoy a good share of health and longevity, and the parish swarms with children.
The Natural History of Selborne, by great naturalist Gilbert White, was the first book to describe many now familiar birds from observations made from the author's 18th century Hampshire village. The audio version is narrated by Benjamin Withrow. And once again, Gabriel Wolfe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Love books? Well, R&IB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. R&IB Library, here for all your reading needs.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.